Hello to everybody who's listening at home. If there's anybody out there. So before I came here tonight, I was learning that the sperm whale weighs up to about 20 tons. I forget how long they are, longer than this building or something like that. Pretty long. And the sperm whale lives most of its life very deep under the water, such that scientists or anybody besides sperm whales and fish know very little about how they actually live, what they actually do, what their daily routine is. They can dive as deep as 6,000 feet, spending most of their time about 1,000 feet deep. And in their very large head is a huge amount of oily fluid. And when people in the 18th century figured out that that was the case, they became the prime target for whaling. Because even though the Industrial Revolution was powered mostly by water power, water wheels and belts and things, that was the source of power, the new machines required oil. And so the Industrial Revolution probably would not have happened had they not started killing whales, because they did not have sources of petroleum or other kinds of oils that were plentiful enough. The metal parts would have just rubbed together and the machines wouldn't have worked. And it turns out that this huge head, I can't remember all the facts now, I should have written this down, but the head itself weighs some tons, with full of this oily fluid, which they didn't know what it was. Only recently did they figure out that it's involved in sound generation. The huge head is used to generate sound. Sound to communicate over very long distances, but also sound that's used to see. And probably if you were a whale, you wouldn't use that verb, to see. Is it to listen? I don't know. But they now know that this seeing with sound is accurate enough that a whale, a sperm whale, can see a squid, which is their main food. There are jumbo squids, which are about so big, and then there's the giant squid, which is 40 or 50 feet long. But anyway, they can see a squid that's about 1 foot long, a mile away through the water. So scientists know this. And so here's this creature living on our planet that we don't really know much about, and that is partly responsible for us sitting in this building and driving our cars and bicycles to get here, living deep beneath the sea. So I was reading this and I thought, well, if that is actually like reality, it's no stranger to have Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Maybe a lot less strange, a lot less strange. So these emptiness teachings maybe have something to say to us about the sort of boundaries of our knowing. And we have an idea of what the world is, but are the world even remotely the same, the world, as the world of a sperm whale, or a bodhisattva of compassion, or a great blue heron, or a fly? It's hard to know. So anyway, I was just before I came here, I wanted to read something while I ate my enchilada, and I found a Smithsonian magazine that was about sperm whales. So I thought you'd enjoy hearing about that. And of course, it's easy to find many more amazing stories from the natural world. So our topic for these 6 weeks is the Heart Sutra, of course. And I mentioned in passing that the Heart Sutra is a very short sort of summary sutra in a way that connects to a much, much larger literature, the Prajnaparamita literature, the wisdom literature of Buddhism, or the wisdom that helps us get beyond these limited views, the wisdom of sperm whales, if you will. And so I thought you might enjoy hearing a little bit of one of the other sutras, just a few passages. This is the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines. And a line is a sort of Sanskrit unit of verse. I forget, it might be like 32 syllables or something like that. And so there are, and the funny thing is that the different sutras, mostly they're named by that by their length. That's the name, is the length. So a different attitude about literature, right? We think literature should have a particular purpose and, you know, and a summary and a title that indicates what the contents is, right? So, but the Prajnaparamita literature is like, well, you've got the Prajnaparamita Sutra of 8,000 lines, the Prajnaparamita Sutra of 25,000 lines, and the Prajnaparamita Sutra of 100,000 lines. And we have the Heart Sutra, which I'm not sure how many lines it is. It may or may not have been written in Sanskrit anyway. So here's a little bit from the Prajnaparamita literature, just to get a little flavor for it. The sutra opens with the usual description of the Buddha giving a talk to the many monks and bodhisattvas, and starting a dialogue with one of them. The Venerable Subhuti, by the Buddha's might, said to the Buddha, this is one of the disciples asking a question. Subhuti said, "You have said, make it clear, Subhuti, to the bodhisattvas, the great beings, starting from perfect wisdom, make it clear from perfect wisdom how the bodhisattvas should go forth into perfect wisdom." So it's a little elliptical there, but one of the disciples saying, "You have told us how to practice perfect wisdom by going into perfect wisdom. And when one speaks of a bodhisattva, what dharma does that word bodhisattva denote?" So I'm going to try not to explain too much. It gets confusing. It's a flavor thing. "I do not, O Buddha, see what this dharma bodhisattva, nor this dharma called perfect wisdom, is." So you told us, you know, work with perfect wisdom and you're a bodhisattva, but Subhuti's saying, what is that really? I don't see what that is. "And neither could I find nor apprehend nor see any dharma bodhisattva, nor see anything called perfect wisdom. So, what bodhisattva shall I instruct and admonish in which perfect wisdom?" You know, what is a bodhisattva and how can I teach them perfect wisdom? I don't see what it is. "And yet, O Buddha, when this is pointed out, a bodhisattva's heart does not become cowed, nor stolid, nor does he or she despair or despond. If she does not turn away or become dejected, does not tremble, is not frightened or terrified, it is just this bodhisattva, this great being, who should be instructed in perfect wisdom. It is precisely this that should be recognized as the perfect wisdom of the bodhisattva, as his instruction and as his instruction in perfect wisdom. When she thus stands firm, that is her instruction in admonition. Moreover, when a bodhisattva courses in perfect wisdom and develops it, he should train himself so he does not pride himself on any thought of enlightenment, because that thought is no thought, since it is essential, original nature, since in its essential, original nature, thought is transparently luminous." I don't know if you followed any of that, but the point being, there is no perfect wisdom. There are no bodhisattvas. And so what's a bodhisattva? A bodhisattva is somebody who doesn't freak out when they realize there's nothing to hold on to. There's no operating manual, basically, is what the Buddha is saying here, through the aegis of this disciple. And not only is there no operating manual, there's nobody who can operate it. And I guess there's no machine either. You could go on with that analogy. So that was one disciple named Subhuti, and here's another disciple whose name we recognize, Shariputra, who's also in our sutra. So Shariputra then says, "Ah, that thought which is no thought, is that something which is? That thought which is no thought, is that something which is?" Said Shariputra. Subhuti responded, "Does there exist, or can one apprehend in this state of absence of thought, either a there is or a there is not?" Shariputra said,
"No, not that."
Subhuti said, "Was it then a suitable question when the venerable Shariputra asked whether that thought which is no thought is something which is?" Shariputra said, "But what then is this state of absence of thought?" It's like, aha, it's a state. It's an absence of thought state. And you can see how this is going to go on for many pages. Subhuti responded, "It is without modification or discrimination." Shariputra said, basically, "Wow. Well, do you expound this, Subhuti, you whom the Lord has declared to be the foremost of those who dwell in peace. And for that reason, because you do not pride yourself on that thought of enlightenment, for that reason, a bodhisattva should be considered incapable of turning away from full enlightenment, and as one who will never cease from taking perfect wisdom to heart. Whether one wants to train on the level of disciple or pratyeka Buddha or bodhisattva, so different training paths, no matter how one trains, one should listen to this perfection of wisdom. Take it up, bear it in mind, study it, recite it, spread it among others. And in this very perfection of wisdom should one be trained and exert oneself. In this very perfection of wisdom should one, endowed with skill and means, exert herself with the aim of procuring all the dharmas which constitute a bodhisattva. In just this perfection of wisdom, all dharmas which constitute a bodhisattva and in which she should be trained and exert himself are indicated in full detail." In full detail. He who wants to train for full enlightenment should also listen to this perfection of wisdom. One who is endowed with skill and means should exert herself in just this perfection of wisdom with the aim of procuring all the dharmas which constitute a Buddha. So there's about a page and a half of a few hundred that go along more or less like that, and you probably already guessed that they're probably never going to tell us what the perfection of wisdom is in any kind of direct way that we can grasp, right? Which is kind of the point of the text. So we had a really fun evening last Friday with Paltol Rinpoche, born in Tibet, now lives in Queens, New York. And one of the best parts, I was saying at breakfast on Saturday, one of the best parts was he's also a doctor, kind of a doctor of Tibetan medicine, which is very similar to Chinese medicine with herbs, and they have their own system of acupuncture, a little different from Chinese. And so he gave a very detailed talk about exactly how you gather the herbs and which mountains to go to and stuff like that. And it was sweet watching him, but it was basically like pretty boring. Like, okay, you know. But then the best part was somebody was asking, one of the neat parts about this long, long description about gathering the herbs on the mountain, and it had many wonderful things, I'm not saying, you know. But it just like, you know, wasn't exactly information we could do much with, which is what we always grasp for, right? So anyway, one of the great things that he kept mentioning was at different points of the process of preparing these medicines, you chant mantras. You chant mantras. And the main mantra that you chant is called the Medicine Buddha Mantra. So Tibet, you know, very elaborate system of iconography and lots of different Buddhas. And one of the Buddhas is the Medicine Buddha. And so somebody asked him, would you be willing to tell us the Medicine Buddha Mantra? And which he said, yes, he would. And then he started telling his life story, which went on for quite a while. And someone said, excuse me, how about the mantra? And then he said, well, now I have to explain to you why it's important to receive the mantra from somebody. And he talked about this sort of system of empowerment and, you know, you could probably look this mantra up on Wikipedia, but, you know, you receive it from somebody, it's much more powerful. He talked about that for quite a while. And then he taught us the mantra, sort of call and response way. And I was thinking about that, you know, a very beautiful, sort of very direct expression of the teachings are received. The teachings are always received from another human being, from another Buddha, is how it's understood. He was sitting in the place of Buddha when he taught us that mantra. And then afterwards, you know, he was hanging out and, you know, showing me his iPhone and stuff. But in that moment, he was like Buddha. We're receiving these teachings from Buddha. And we don't do that quite as explicitly in our tradition, you know, especially as it's expressed with Norman. We have a kind of a light touch. But then I thought, but actually we are doing exactly that, you know. I mean, all this information is really available, right? I mean, you could get this book and you could read it yourself and all the other books we've suggested. And you could go online and, you know, the information's all there. And even the Buddhist systems where they have a lot of secret teachings, a lot of the secret teachings are now available. But in a way, all the teachings are secret even though they're available. Because you don't fully bring it into your heart until you're ready to receive it, right? And that receiving is a relationship. It's a moment of relationship, right? It's a moment of connection between beings. And so I was thinking about the Heart Sutra in the same way. I mean, here's this funny little text. We had the first week or so, I think we talked about the Chinese pilgrim Xuanzang, who brought this little text to China in the 8th century. And then it's been brought forward to us by all kinds of people, most of whose stories we don't know. But, you know, we could have just, like, the text could have been lost and we could have rediscovered it 1,000 years later and had this text, but it wouldn't have been the same. Somehow, there's something about the way it was brought forward. And one of the people who brought the wisdom teachings that the Heart Sutra is in the center of forward is the fellow who translated this longer version that I was reading to you. A German man named Edward, I guess, Kanza. And this is a reissue of one of his many books about the Prajnaparamita literature, and it has a nice little pithy biography of his life. So I want to tell you the story of Edward Kanza, because it's really interesting. And you just think about, you know, the incredible chain of circumstances that led us to this day. I mean, how could this be, you know? How could this be that we're sitting here in Red Cedar Dharma Hall having teachings about the Heart Sutra? And the other thing, you know, that's especially true of the Heart Sutra is without teachings and commentary, it would just be like, you know? On its own, you know, just the words. You know, don't have the whole thing is not just the words. Somehow, it's the way it's been enlivened and handed down through all these centuries. So here's a little about Edward Kanza, who did the first reliable translations of this material into English, even though he himself was German. An Anglophile son of Germany in the 1910s and 1920s, Kanza rejected the militarism in his homeland and displayed an abiding curiosity in poetry and philosophy. As a boy of 13, he happened upon Lafsadio Hearn's Gleanings in Buddha Fields, in his father's library, which is like one of the first Western books on Buddhism, maybe the first. And he was memorized by its essay on enlightenment, liberally sprinkled with quotations from the Diamond Sutra. Much later, Kanza wrote, "When I read these words, I felt that they represented a truth which I had once known, but which had faded as I grew up." Yet he wondered if these were the actual words of the sutra. After all, he was reading a German translation from the English, done by an Italian guy, from the Japanese, and from the Chinese, successive translations of a Sanskrit original. And in that moment, as a young man, he resolved to gain access to the original text. And 40 years later, he published this very translation, which is still regarded as the standard edition. At least when it was published, it was. After completing his doctorate in philosophy in 1928, Kanza began the study of the Sanskrit language in Bonn. But in 1933, the Nazi regime's aggression drove him to London, and there he pieced together a hapless existence as a communist, a political critic, and a gadfly professor without appointment, until his rediscovery of Buddhism in the person of the Japanese Zen scholar D.T. Suzuki. It doesn't say whether they actually matter, or he just was inspired by D.T. Suzuki's writing. Re-inspired, Kanza resumed his Sanskrit studies at Oxford, and without academic appointment, he translated, lectured, and wrote on Buddhism. And in 1951, he published the classic essay, Buddhism, Its Essence and Its Development, which has probably graced more classrooms than any other introductory Buddhist textbooks. Through all his personal struggles and the professional and professional acclaim, Kanza's devotion to the Prajnaparamita literature remained a constant in his life. He began his painstaking translation in 1946 of the earliest text, the Sutra in 8,000 Lines. So that's this one. which he published with the Primitive Indian Press in 1958. Subsequently, he published translations of all of the extant Prajnaparamita Sutras in at least abbreviated form, along with essays surveying the literature, anthologies, and topical sketches, a dictionary of linguistic equivalents, and numerous articles. While certain of his conclusions have since been challenged in more recent scholarship, the body of his work has never been duplicated. This kind of makes me tear up a little bit. Amazing. In his later years, Professor Khanza taught frequently in the United States as a distinguished visiting professor. Irascible to the end, Khanza nevertheless waxed eloquent in his precious Prajnaparamita. At several universities, he was chastised by academic deans for his tendency to go quite beyond this mere scholarly elucidation, venturing into his own versions of the traditional Dharma talk. Though he never formally studied with Buddhist teachers, never took Buddhist vows, never visited Asia, and never once engaged in formal meditation practice, he had an uncanny, intuitive connection with these teachings. In his memoir, he reflected, "From early times onwards, it has been my conviction that I have come from a higher realm, and that my great knowledge of the Mahayana And my great knowledge of the Mahayana cannot be explained by why I could study in this life, but is based on my memory of what I learned before, and that I was sent to the Western barbarians so as to soften their hearts by teaching them the holy Prajnaparamita." And one of the last places that he was a regular gadfly was UC Berkeley, which is where a few years after he retired, Norman Fisher came along in 1970 to study poetry and started doing meditation at Berkeley Zen Center down the street. And then about 20 years later, His Holiness the Dalai Lama started to teach in America, which, you know, he had not before that. It's hard to remember that not that long ago nobody had heard of the Dalai Lama, you know, but it's really true. And one of the first extended teachings that he gave on Buddhist texts for, not just for monks in exile, Tibetan monks, was a series of teachings on the Heart Sutra given in Mountain View, California. And Norman Fisher was there. And that teachings became this book. So see, it's interesting, huh? And then right around the same time in Ojai, California, a Vietnamese teacher, also not well known, named Thich Nhat Hanh, gave a series of teachings on the Heart Sutra. And a young Zen student named Peter Levitt was there. And he edited this book. So, yeah. So the Heart Sutra came to us through many different channels, you know. But all, you know, living, breathing human beings, many of whom we actually know and have met and hung around with, you know, who also, you know, have their quirks and confusions and forget about these teachings and remember them again, just like we do. So last week we were talking a lot about the five skandhas and how it seems to be what the opening part of the sutra is saying. When Avalokiteshvara has this sort of realization about how to end suffering, is that the method seems to not be about sort of like forgetting about our experience or going beyond our actual lived experience. That the method mentioned in the Heart Sutra has more to do with entering deeply into our experience as it actually is, seeing it more accurately, sort of penetrating into it. And we played around with the famous formula. Excuse me if you're just hearing this for the first time, but maybe something will be interesting. The famous formula that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Because we were saying that form is just one category, you know, one category of experience, and there are these other categories, these five aggregates, five skandhas. And form was used as an example, but it says in there, it means everything. And we also were playing around with the translation of emptiness, which is a difficult Buddhist concept, which actually is very simple in a way. And we thought instead of saying emptiness, we could say boundlessness, the sense of things not being divided, not being so divided as we think, so boundless or interpenetrated. Or Thich Nhat Hanh invented the English term interdependent, which we just think is a regular word, but actually Thich Nhat Hanh invented that in the 1970s. Yeah. Yeah. Probably because he's trying to figure out how the hell he's going to explain this. You know? These really sweet people, so adoring, but they're not getting it, you know. So then we thought, well, we can take this formula, form is emptiness, emptiness form, and we can do stuff with it, like thought is boundless. Boundlessness is thought. And then that's great, you know, because it takes the pressure off of our spiritual progress. We don't have to have some big spiritual experience where thought sort of implodes and there's white lights and stuff, and you know, that can happen. But this seems to be very practical, very grounded. You know, understand your thinking in a different way, maybe. Understand the boundlessness of thinking and the ways that you are bound by the way you usually think about thinking. But then, just like in our little exchange between Shariputra and Subhuti, the next thought up on deck, isn't it? Isn't the next thought up on deck is like, oh good, now I have a method to get to a better state, right? That's what Subhuti was saying, right? Oh, so is this a state of no thought? That sounds really nice, you know, I'm like, my thoughts are driving me nuts, you know? That the mind has a deep desire to grasp, right? And so, in a way, these emptiness teachings are not a teaching, right? They're more of a process. Entering deeply into our experience and opening the hand again, right? Releasing again from grasping. And there's another kind of grasping. I want some other kind of life, right? I want a way to be freed from my crazy thinking. I want a state of no thought. Which isn't wrong exactly. Something really does happen. We all know that from our experience of meditation. Even if this is our first night doing practice, something happens, right? It's not like nothing happens. But somehow these sort of jaws of limitation snap shut around us so quickly, right? So easily. Oh, if I practice the right way, I will be happy. So there's I, right? And there's happy, like fixed ideas. I as opposed to you, happy as opposed to unhappy. So is the Heart Sutra suggesting something other than that, something beyond that? So Prajnaparamita is wisdom that goes beyond. So what is the wisdom beyond happy and unhappy? Is that a sort of true happiness? Or is that just another concept? And then the sutra continues. So we have to at least get in a line of the sutra under our belts here. And if you want to be looking at this, it's page, what, 5 maybe?
Yes.
Page 5. So after Avalokiteshvara has this great insight, or explains this insight with the Buddha's help, that the aggregates are empty and was freed from all suffering, she started with one description of emptiness in form in the skandhas, and then went on to say, and Kanza calls this the second stage in the dialectics of emptiness. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, got a little typo here. Can I have a copy of the chant book? Thank you. Suddenly it's my words are mixed into the sutra, but I mean, that's how it works too. Sariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. So to us, this is just the next line of the sutra, but if you think about it, this is a big deal. At first, Avalokiteshvara is just talking about our own experience, these aggregates, these skandhas, it's our own experience. And that makes sense, to say your own experience isn't so sort of bound and narrow as you thought it was. But now this is saying, not just your own experience, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. All dharmas are not so fixed that you can see them arise and cease, that they could be have a quality of purity or a quality of impurity. And dharmas here means experience of everything. It's a sort of Buddhist term for sort of like an atom of experience, a moment of experience. And, in Western thought, we make a big distinction between mind and matter, right? Mind and matter is our big distinction when it's so baked into our language and our thinking that we don't think about it too much. But we think that there are real existent things that are matter, and those are really good. You can measure them, you can study them, you can build with them, you can have the Industrial Revolution with them. You know, you can write and read, you know, these are all matter. And the mind is like sort of subjective and a little mushier, right, and emotional, and, you know, the realm of religion and maybe psychology. And so in our dialectic, this is the sort of big distinction, mind and matter, with matter being privileged, right? Although now I was thinking about this and now with this great sort of boom in neurology and cognitive psychology, in a way, maybe those are coming back together. You know, they can see the brain lining up in different ways and they associate that with states of mind. Or maybe that's just like an even more subtle way that our culture is just driving matter forward. Like, now we're going to take the mind and turn it into matter, damn it, you know. We can measure it now, you know. That was really bothering us, you know. Now we're all freed up. And of course, that'll hit some limitation before long. The mind is certainly seems to be more than the brain.
Or the mind is like software.
Yeah, right. The mind is just software. Yeah, right. It's just an analogy. We're nothing but a metaphor. The real reality is a machine. Yeah. So anyway, that's the big distinction in Western thought. But the big distinction in Buddhist thought is not that. It's not that at all. Matter is just one of many categories of these dharmas, of these experienceable, you know, items, experienceablenesses, if you will. And the big distinction in Buddhist thought is between the conditioned dharmas and the unconditioned dharmas. So this is worth knowing a little bit of technical jargon here. Sorry, but it's baked into our sutra. So the conditioned dharmas are pretty much what we usually experience. Condition means one thing affects another. So there's cause and effect. So, you know, somebody yelling at me is a conditioning dharma that could influence, you know, another dharma arising. You know, then I get upset. It's another dharma. Anger is a dharma. Sound is a dharma. You know, different kinds of cognition are different dharmas. And so they work together, right? And so that's one of the big ideas of emptiness. No one of these is really separate. They're completely mixed together and co-creating each other. But in Buddhist thought, there are three dharmas that are not that way, that are not that way at all, that are unconditioned. And this is from early Buddhist thought. In early Buddhist thought, there's about 75 total, by the way, 75 categories of dharmas. There's a few different systems. But the Sarvastivadin system that this is based on is 75. So 72 of them are all these different experiences and colors and forms and emotions and thoughts and impulses and just all the sort of maelstrom that's our life, right? But then there's these three that are just free of all that. This is like liberation and freedom. And the three unconditioned dharmas are space, which is kind of like we think of space in science, you know, an absence of anything. And so how could space be conditioned by anything? Space is just space. And then the other two are two different versions of nirvana. And we could have many Dharma talks about nirvana, and there's many different commentaries, and, you know, who really knows what nirvana is. But in early Buddhist thought, nirvana is the Dharma that's free from conditioning that can be experienced by human beings. And there's two different levels of it, which we won't get into. And so in early Buddhist thought, you know, part of the idea was through practice we can touch these unconditioned dharmas. We can have an experience of these unconditioned dharmas. And this is true for us too. Sometimes it's pretty subtle. Sometimes it's more obvious. And I think we all have now or have had in the past some experience with this peacefulness, with this moment of life where things just are, do you know what I mean? And sometimes you forget about those experiences because there's not much to hold on to. It's like a dream almost. You can't really remember your dream so well, right? Just a moment when, you know, there's no grasping, right? No tightness, just openness in some way. And oftentimes we associate that with conditioned dharmas, like we associate that experience with seeing something, a beautiful sunset or looking into our lover's eyes or something. There's an association there. But the understanding is these unconditioned dharmas, these nirvana experiences, if you will, are actually just there. They're just there. They aren't created or conditioned by anything. And they're kind of there all the time. But the Heart Sutra is saying, well, that's a little sort of limited, you know, to have like all this mess over here that you want to get rid of, and there's some peaceful something off in the horizon somewhere. So the Heart Sutra says, see beyond even that. You know, allow your heart and your practice to flow right through that big dichotomy, that big division, into a life that is not one, not the other, not both, not neither, not neither. It's just life, I guess. And so in here where it says all dharmas are marked by emptiness, it's saying that everything, the conditioned dharmas and the unconditioned dharmas, have this quality of being completely boundless, completely not separate. And one of the ideas of early Buddhist thought was the dharmas are sort of separate. Like you can reduce things down, like we're kind of mixed up thinking that this is me and this is my agenda and this is my preferences. I can really study more carefully. I can see, oh, a thought, you know. Oh, an experience of pleasant. Oh, an experience of physicality, right? We can sort of winnow down our elaborated kind of conceptual idea of our experience down to just these dharmas, you know. If we can just these things as just the dharmas, oh, there's the dharma, there's the dharma, there's the dharma, then there won't be anything to grasp or hold on to because, like, just dharmas, you know, it's not you, you know, it's just your dharmas. Or just not even your dharmas, just dharmas. No, you there. But then the Heart Sutra is saying, even that is kind of a limited view. Even that is sort of narrow in its way. It's sort of a kind of a grasping. And so actually it's all marked by emptiness, or you could say marked by boundlessness. So it's sort of an illusion to think that they arise and cease, that they could be defiled or pure. And this word marked in here is a very deliberately chosen word. So some words in here actually are keying into an enormous literature all by themselves. So that's why this text is so sort of dense and hard to unpack. So that they use the adjective marked is really important. All dharmas are marked by emptiness, the third paragraph, first line of the third paragraph. Because one of Buddha's core teachings about the dharmas, about the reality of our life, was that we suffer because we don't know how things really go, right? We suffer because we don't know how things really go. This later came to be called the Four Noble Truths, right? Which is not life is suffering, so please don't keep saying that if any of you say that to somebody. It's not life is suffering. It's a sort of a more subtle analysis. It's more like life misunderstood is suffering. A misunderstood reality is suffering. And the Buddha said one of the first things we need to understand about each moment of reality is it actually has three marks, has three essential qualities, which the Heart Sutra is now going to implode, but we start there because it's useful, you know? Stuff's really useful. And I think it's really useful to us to have a sense of we can practice with these earlier Buddhist teachings and we can have a light touch because we have Avalokiteshvara looking over our shoulder just loving us, you know what I'm saying? You can let all that go, you know? Practice with it and let it go. So the three marks of reality, according to the Buddha and early Buddhist teachings, are, first, impermanence. So this is not just like things are permanent for a while and then they're impermanent. It's more like it's baked into reality. Baked into reality. Everything down to the smallest atom of experience is just here and gone. Totally impermanent, right? Nothing. There's nothing that lasts. Nothing that lasts. There's an appearance of things lasting, but it's actually just like a whole set of circumstances arising and changing and falling away in some complicated pattern. So even this lectern, right? It's not actually solid in the way we think it is. So the first quality is impermanence. And this is really useful, right? This is really useful for us to study. And how do we study it? We notice when we suffer. And when we suffer, we kind of peel back the layers a little bit and we can see, oh, look at that. There's a desire for permanence there, right? There's a desire for permanence. We want things we like to stay. We want things we don't like to go away, and you know, in many subtle levels and obvious levels. So the first is impermanence. Sanskrit and Pali, they're the same. It's anicca, or impermanence. And the second one is not self. This gets a little harder to understand from our point of view. There's not an equivalent word in English. Anatta, not self or non-self. It's connected to impermanence, but the idea is that nothing has any kind of identity. That even the idea of identity or being able to identify something as a this and not a that is a kind of an illusion, based again on this sort of co-arising of all these composite factors, including our own history and our language and our childhood and the people around us and how they're, you know, and so on and so forth. That nothing has identity, down to the smallest moment of experience. Nothing has identity. So impermanent, not no identity, anicca, anatta. And the third mark of reality is dukkha, which is what gets translated as suffering. This is why sometimes we misunderstand Buddhism. It sounds like it's saying life is suffering, or like reality is suffering, like the basis of reality is suffering. Oh, no! So this really sounds bad, but what the Buddha is saying, though, is we look for a kind of a narrow satisfaction in that which is not going to provide that kind of satisfactoriness. It's the sort of unclingableness of things is this dukkha, is this not satisfying. And so it might be that, you know, it's just mixes us up to try to put English words in this stuff, and we should just learn the Pali and Sanskrit words, and we have all these different languages we have to deal with. But anicca, anatta, and dukkha. And it's really wonderful, you know, to really experientially, you know, in practice, in daily life, just be asking ourselves. You could take one of them up for a day or a week or a year, you know. What is impermanence here? You know, what is the desire for permanence here? You know, what is change here? You know, or where am I looking for? What am I identifying with? You know, what am I? And it gets subtle, you know, but and you can just notice, you know, in a moment of zazen, just like there's like some experience, and then thoughts rise out of the depths, and there's some sense of identifying something, right? So can we kind of soften around that? And then the third one, you know, is very experiential, you know. You know, where are we not satisfied? You know, where, in obvious and subtle ways, what are the ways that something just doesn't quite feel right? Not what I wanted. And to actually feel that, you know, to actually experience that as a moment-by-moment quality of reality. And, you know, which sounds like a downer, but what the Buddha is saying is that if we see this accurately, we'll be completely freed up, you know? It will liberate us, because we will just learn how to allow reality to be reality, allow this experience of our life to be this experience of our life without clinging. You know, we still are an actor in this play, right? We're still trying to do things, we're still making decisions, but without, you know, without the grasping. So it'd be wonderful. Maybe one day we'll do a retreat, you know, a long retreat, and just be like, impermanence day, you know, not self day. Just breathe with that and see if we can find a lot of different commentaries and poems and, you know, experiential activities to help us sort of explore that territory. So that's what the next line of the sutra is saying, is deeply recognizing, one way to read it is deeply recognizing that there are dharmas and they are marked by these three marks, and they, on a moment-by-moment level, they come and they go. Some are pure and blissful, some are sticky and stinky and nasty. One is not better than the other. We're just recognizing that reality. And then the Heart Sutra is saying, and now just flow right through that, right through the other side, right through the other shore. No need to worry about what's marked. Everything's just emptiness. Everything's boundless. The marks The marks fall apart. The marks flow away. And there's just this. Nothing increasing, nothing decreasing. And later they're even going to make this a similar claim about life and death, right? Which is our biggest concern. Which is our biggest concern. We don't want death. We don't want death for anybody. We don't want death for ourselves. And the sutra seems to be saying something about flowing right through that concept too. Because it is a concept, right? It is a concept. It's a deeply held concept. It's a very powerful concept, but it is a concept. It's an idea. Life and death. How much time do we have left? I forgot my watch today.
Almost quarter to nine.
Okay. Let's, how many people do we have? Yeah, we actually have a multiple of three. I want to have a very short group of three discussion, and we won't do the whole structured thing with the bell. It'll just be like a more casual conversation between the three of you. And there are two possible topics. One is to talk about your own history with the Heart Sutra. Just reflect back on, how did this sutra come into my life, you know, and how, what is it meant for me? Sometimes it's sort of mysterious and strange, and it's interesting to sort of open your mouth and reflect on that. And the other possibility, connected possibility for a short conversation, is what do these teachings on emptiness, you know, what are they for me? Many of us have been studying this for many times, and some of us they're kind of new. But just to say out loud with your in your little small group a little bit about what is this, you know, for me? How do I practice with this? How does this help me, or how does it seem useful, or kind of where do I go with this? What are my associations maybe with emptiness? What does it, I don't know what, you know, how you want to talk about that. What emotion, what color, what temperature is emptiness for you? What is the feeling of touching the empty nature of reality? Okay? Let's divide up real quick and we'll just have a short conversation and spread around the room in groups of three. Just whoever you're close to. If you're at home, you should reflect on these things for a few minutes, maybe pause the recording. The great thing about the the emptiness teachings is in addition to the vast amounts of traditional commentaries and all the Buddhist lingo and stuff, it just really seems like you run into different things like sperm whales and different things. It just kind of reminds you like, oh, that's emptiness too somehow. So I'm going to read you a little bit, a few lines from Freeman Dyson. Freeman Dyson is a physicist. He is 88 years old. He's been still working all his life, and he's connected to us because his son George lives in Bellingham, where he makes, and his daughter too, huh? Yeah, you know his daughter? And so they have a Bellingham connection. And a magazine called Intelligent Life has been interviewing people who are still active and working well into their 80s and asking them a set of questions. And so I want to read you a few of his answers. One of the questions was, what advice would you give to those who have been working for A, 1 year, and B, 30 years? So his answer to 3A, people who have been working for 1 year, is, do not imagine that you have to know everything before you can do anything. My own best work was done when I was most ignorant. Grab every opportunity to take responsibility and do things for which you are unqualified. Good? Don't think you need to know everything before you start doing anything. My own best work was done when I was the most ignorant. Grab every opportunity to take responsibility and do things for which you are unqualified. Then his advice for people who have been working for 30 years. Do not be afraid to switch careers and try something new. As my friend, the physicist Leo Slizlard said, number 9 in his own list of 10 commandments, do your work for 6 years, but in the 7th go into solitude or among strangers, so that the memory of your friends does not hinder you from being what you have become and what you can become. Is that good? Yeah. Do your work for 6 years, but in the 7th go into solitude or among strangers, so that the memory of your friends does not hinder you from being what you have become. So that's an emptiness teaching, isn't it? You know, what are the ways that we sort of bind each other in a certain position through our ideas about who we are and who you are? Yeah. So that's maybe our challenge and our long, and you know, our life together in Sangha. Someone was asking me in the mindfulness-based stress reduction class in Seattle, you know, which is like this temporary 8-week thing, and then it's a class, and classes end, and someone was asking me, well, what do you do that's any different from this? And I realized the only essential difference, something that's very similar to meditation practices, is we stick around for 20 or 30 years. And so, yeah, so how can we, with each other, you know, with each other. So our challenge is, how can we let ourselves really be something new, you know, be something new. So I thought you'd enjoy Freeman Dyson's wisdom there. I thought we would close our evening tonight by chanting the Heart Sutra in Japanese. And one pronunciation note, this is page 7 and into 8, is that the way Japanese is romanized, the letter I is pronounced E. The letter I is pronounced E. So kanji, although AI is I. Kanji zai bo satsu gyo jin hanya hara mita. So just make the I very E-ish. But let's be good and loud. And I won't go too fast so we can have time to get our mouths around these syllables. And remember what else is cool about this language, sort of a semi-language, is that this is the way the Japanese decided to pronounce Chinese characters from the Tang Dynasty. And so this is not the way modern Japanese is pronounced. So a modern Japanese person looking at the actual characters, it wouldn't make that much sense to them. So it's kind of the whole thing in a very literal way as a mantra, you know, without having sort of conventional meaning. You wouldn't go around saying to somebody, ah, kanji zaibo zatsu gyo, you know, it wouldn't make any sense. So it's a sort of, you know, it's like church Latin maybe or something like that. Okay, I'll announce it and then we'll chant and I'll do the drum. Maka hanya harumita shingyo ganji za zatsugyo jin hanya haramita jisho gengo an ikudo isai yu yakusha rishi jikibui kufu Okay.
tendo su so ku gyo ne han san de sho butsu e han ya haramita and okutara samyaku sambo dai ko chi han ya haramita de dai jin shu se myo shu se Shin Jitsu Fuko Ko Suhanya Haramita Shu Soku Setsu Shu Gyate Hara Gyate Hara So Gyate Bo Soaka Hanya Shingo.
Really good. We'd have a little dedication to do in Sino-Japanese too, which is also cool because then in the formal ceremonies they do the dedication in the same language, which they don't really understand what it means. It's like all magic, you know? It's all magic. So, and the other thing that's neat is if you memorize this, it's done exactly the same throughout the world. That they took the one translation from Xuanzang, from Chinese, the dominant translation from the 8th century, and they turned it into, you know, this way of pronouncing it. But since it's 260 characters, it's not like English where you can kind of jiggle or, you know, it's those characters. It's exactly those characters. So if you memorize this and you show up at a Zen center in Zurich or somewhere, they'll chant it just like that. Yeah. Or Japan or Mexico, anywhere. So that's enough for tonight. Thanks very much. Oh, I just wanted to get a sense of how many people know that they'll be here next week? Because we're going to do something experiential next week, and I have to do, like, setups. 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, probably. Okay, thanks. And I will not tell you what happens.